My name is Norma Jean Strumman, and the title of this session is Intentional Caregiving, We Are Treasure in Earthen Vessels. Yesterday, I started off with some poetic images, and I'd like to do the same thing today to kind of set the tone for this session. And the first one I'd like to read is by Isadora Duncan from this wonderful book of In the Midst of Winter. Duncan lost both of her young children when a taxicab in which they were riding fell in the water and they were drowned. After their death, she fled to her friend, the Italian actress Eleonora Duse, at Duse's villa in Italy. Duse did not offer Isadora Duncan easy or trite prescriptions for her enormous loss. She allowed Duncan to feel what had happened to her, surely the most tender and generous gesture of consolation.
Well, right after we
on the board up here behind me, I've listed some of the themes that will run through this session and that run through all the sessions I'm doing, which I think this is part of. One of the things is that speech, when we can bring our pain to speech or our story to speech as caregivers, we are engaging in a life-giving process. And the contrary, since the theme of this week is contraries, is isolation and silence. It's come up in every session this week. It comes up with everybody I work with. And I just believe it's very true that if we cannot talk about what we're hurting about, we feel isolated. If we can't talk to other people about what they're hurting about, they feel isolated. And that's very much like death. Another theme is that pain, loss, and grief are transformed by relationship, and only Christ really has the power of that transformation. But because we are believers, because we are Christians, we are engaging in that life-giving process as we caregive with other people and with ourselves. And if you've read, some of you have read Matthew Fox, The Original Blessing, one of the themes in that book is that eventually in the healing process, and we're at all different stages along the road, we're walking in on a journey into ecstasy, into the experience of God. But that is a long healing process. And Fox also says that we have to name it in order to let go of it. People will come and look at the title for this session. Oh, this is about death. Forget it. I'm going to leave. I don't want to talk about that. Any kind of grief, any kind of pain or loss that's underneath the surface, I believe it's true of life, and everything I've ever read and everything I've experienced about the Christian faith is that mysteriously in the power of the resurrection, it is transformed into healing. And we don't enter into it to nurture it in a sick kind of way or to hang on to it, but to let go of it. Yesterday I also read three little vignettes from this wonderful book called The Book of Qualities. And today I'd like to begin by reading three more that I think have to do very much with the theme of caregiving. The first one is on courage. Courage has roots. She sleeps on a futon on the floor and lives close to the ground. Courage looks you straight in the eye. She is not impressed with power trippers, and she knows first aid. Courage is not afraid to weep, and she is not afraid to pray, even when she is not sure who she is praying to. When she walks, it is clear that she has made the journey from loneliness to solitude. The people who told me she is stern were not lying. They just forgot to mention that she is kind. And then another one on wisdom. And I'm reading these because these are qualities that are necessary for us as caregivers. Wisdom wears an indigo jacket. She takes long walks in the purple hills at twilight, pausing to meditate at an old temple near the crossroads. She was sick as a young child, so she learned to be alone with herself at an early age. Wisdom has a quiet mind. She likes to think about the edges, where things spill into each other and become their opposites. She knows how to look at things inside and out. Sometimes her eyes go out to the things she is looking at, and sometimes the thing she is looking at enters through her eyes. Questions of time, depth, and balance interest her. She is not looking for answers. And then one on compassion. Compassion wears Saturn's rings on the fingers of her left hand. She is intimate with the life force. She understands the meaning of sacrifice. She is not afraid to die, and there is nothing you cannot tell her. Compassion speaks with a slight accent. She was a vulnerable child, miserable in school, cold, shy, alert to the pain in the eyes of her sturdier classmates. The other kids teased her about being too sentimental, and for a long time she believed them. In ninth grade, she was befriended by Courage. Courage lent Compassion bright sweaters, explained the slang, showed her how to play volleyball, and taught her that you can love people and not care what they think about you. In many ways, Compassion is still the stranger, neither wonderful nor terrible, but always herself, utterly. What I get out of these personifications of those qualities is, first of all, from the first reading, the need to express and own our own feelings so that we can give that to other people. When we're talking about intentional caregiving, I don't believe we can effectively reach out to people if we don't give ourselves the same permission to enter into our own pain and darkness so that we can receive. This is one of the images we're using this year, the broken vessel, the broken treasure carved out with pain. And if we've allowed ourselves to explore the places in our lives where we've been hurting, then I think we are compassionate toward other people that are hurting instead of judgmental or instead of shutting it off. If we're shutting it off in ourselves, then I think the equation is we shut it off in other people. I think it takes a lot of courage to do intentional caregiving. And we'll notice the top, I say intentional caregiving, and what I mean by that is it's the opposite of good intentions that never happen. People in grief or people, you know, you on the side of caregiving yourself, you know, you might mean to reach out to someone and say, well, let's get together, or I really should reach out to them. And you really mean well, but if you don't do anything about it, it's interpreted as silence. And over again, people that I work with, and I've experienced this myself, say, so-and-so doesn't come around. They don't talk to me. They won't talk to me about, and I'm coming from the framework of loss through death. There are hosts of griefs and kinds of losses. But I'm thinking of, if you know someone in your congregation, your community, in your circle of friends, your family that has been traumatized by the death of someone that they love very close to them, the wisdom of that is to know that whether or not they appear to be in grief, they are. And it takes courage to look that in the eye, to be not afraid to weep. And I like the phrase where courage was on her own journey from loneliness to solitude, to embrace that in herself. That wisdom to be an intentional caregiver means we're nurturing ourselves very well, that we have learned how to be alone. And it talked, remember, about living on the edges. People in pain, severe pain from a severe loss, feel like they're living on the edge. That was in the video yesterday when Nancy spoke about, you feel like you're a real cold cup of coffee, you know, around people. You don't feel like you're entering into life of other people around you. Also, that compassion, as it described this ninth grader, you know, sort of the outsider in the ninth grade, the junior high thing, was befriended by courage, and this incredible mutuality that came out of that. So when we befriend someone else, we're entering into a relationship of mutuality that is very life-giving. I've been talking in this series about how I use images when I lead the grief groups that I do, and how I believe that's a powerful teaching tool. Because that's come up in some of the sessions this week, and there's a whole body of literature research that's done in the educational field that we can relearn, we can be healed by images. Jesus taught in images. One of the images that came out of the text study this morning was, if you gave a feast, the marriage feast, for yourself, who would come? What parts of yourself would sit around the table? I think that's a powerful image to work with. Especially in grief, who would they all be? And it's not only the glitzy, the things that look good and the things that look terrific, but it's all the lame and the halt and the broken parts of ourselves would all be sitting around the table. So part of the image I'd like to lift up today, some of the images, are that I think intentional caregiving is this kind of a thing. It's surrounding someone who's not well or in some kind of brokenness. And by the same artist, it's the image of the feast. I love these images, that intentional caregiving is community around pain. And that this is the life-giving process we're really involved in, is that new life, the crocus, comes out of the ice. That's the miracle of nature, and we are part of that. And by cross, the death and resurrection, this is the process. These images of the circle being our relationships that have been broken into. We have patches and mended places. And then the angel, in terms of intentional caregiving, who are the angels in your life? Now, some other quick images I'm just going to flash by. On any given day when I lead the support groups where I work, I have a whole pack. I just keep accumulating ideas for images that can be used. And I'll just flash through them very quickly, and then hopefully that will be a jumping off point for discussion. By the way, you all know about left brain and right brain research and education, and I really believe that in healing grief work, whether you find yourself writing cards to people or being in a group in your parish, wherever you find yourself plugging into that kind of work or outreach, to use images. One of my friends is a therapist in Sioux Falls, and she does psychodrama, and one of her is her therapy. And one of the things she says is that only so long you can sit and talk about what's happened to you or what's happened to other people, but you need to move on. And I believe very much the Bible is full of life-giving images, and so to teach in that way or to present images and to share images is one of the really powerful ways that we can experience healing. So intentional caregiving is planting seeds, i.e. if you're reaching out to someone, sometimes all it takes is a touch on their elbow at coffee hour and a look in the eye, meet their eye, and let them know that you know of their pain. Now, there's a whole bunch of us walking around that have a whole bunch of pain. Maybe no one's died in our family that no one knows about. And I'm talking about the obvious things. If someone's had a death in your congregation, you're planting a seed. You're letting them know that you're there. I have an angel collection. It's one of my little collections. And this is a community that we're in, a sister congregation with from El Salvador. And they sent me this, so I have this sitting on my desk at home. But who are the angels in your life, and who can you be an angel to? And that's an ongoing call process that I think happens in congregational life of caregiving and reaching out to people that you know very well who are suffering from whatever. Again, I'm into greeting cards, as you can see. The heart has reasons that reason cannot understand. That whatever place we are at in our grief issues, it is not always rational. It doesn't always, you cannot always use words to describe it. It doesn't always make sense cognitively. Love is still the most powerful force in the world. One of the people in my group whose daughter committed suicide in March says, I can't handle knowing stages of grief. All I want right now is the love of this community to get me through this period of time. And that's what we are as intentional caregivers, is love. Our lives are shaped by those who love us. Now, how I would use these is just maybe to have a theme on the centerpiece. And those images, as we are focusing on those as a group, are evoking things in all of us throughout the session. So this is just one way if you do any teaching or that kind of thing. I really believe that this is true. There is no growth without pain. I think when we can point to the points in our lives when we have experienced incredible, maybe leaps in growth, it's been through pain that we would not choose. One of my images at Holden Village is you have all these teachers giving all these courses, and so this one would be pain as a teacher. I don't think very many people want to walk in that door, i.e. but like it or not, it's one of the visitors that comes knocking, and there we are. There are times when prayer is the only gift we can give one another. I shared a story about that from my own life yesterday. When you walked in prolonged pain, i.e. a terminal illness or other kinds of grief that seemingly have no end, mental illness or disabilities or things you do not wish, you wish for anything that they could be healed and be whole, and it just seems like they'll never change. There are times when the prayer is the only gift. This is an icon painting from a retreat center back in Minnesota, the Ark Retreat Center, the prophet Elijah listening. And a huge part of intentional caregiving is listening, just being with another person and not giving them all kinds of solutions and agendas. I'm dealing with a woman now whose two children drowned on the same day last year in our huge lake back home. They were 3 and 4, two little sweet little boys, and she was busy and they toddled off, never have done anything like this before, and were waiting, and she went to search for them and they both drowned. And this is, she came into the group in February, and I love the way, one of the things she said, when, you know that little verse, the footsteps, you know that, I should know it by heart, but that, it's on postcards and it's on, it's, oh, Jesus carrying you. Yeah. Anyway, it's one of these little prayers. It's very common. It's on every grief shelf in every drugstore. She says, you know that I've gotten about 15 of those cards? She said, I do not feel like I'm being carried right now. That does not comfort me. If so, help me. If one more person sends me that card, I'm going to punch him in the mouth. You know? And anyway, so part of being with Diane right now and doing grief work with her and walking with her is an enormous amount of just listening. She is not going to be comforted by platitudes that we think might comfort.
She's in the anger state.
You bet. And a lot of stuff is other issues. And so, okay, another part of intentional caregiving is that we're really giving ourselves gifts. It's not patronizing. Intentional caregiving is a mutual kind of an enterprise. And that one of the reasons I get an enormous amount of ecstasy and joy out of doing this kind of work, now professionally working in a funeral home setting, but I have been doing it out of my own life experience really all my life, is because in the mystery of the cross, that's what this is. It's Walter Brueggemann has taught me a lot about that, my favorite theologian, that to walk with people in pain, to walk in the conversation with your own pain, is to experience the joy of death and resurrection, and it leads you into ecstasy, leads you into God. That's the theology of the cross, which I don't have any easy explanation for, but I know it's true, as opposed to denying it and stuffing it and wanting only to be on the side of what's good and seems to be glory. A friend is a present you give yourself. And sometimes when I use this as an image, I like bright primary colors. And to think of yourself as a gift wrap package, because that's what each of us is. To other people as intentional caregivers, that you are a very unique person placed in a very unique point in time and space, and God, I believe, calls us to wake up and notice people who are in our community, in our families, in our whatever, wherever we live, and image yourself as a great big gift package to that person. But it takes, the focus of this session is intentionality. They will never know that you're a gift if you don't say something, if you don't let them know you're there, or whatever form that takes. And I think it can take a lot of imagination and a lot of creativity, as only you have, to the people that God is calling you to minister to and with. Just quickly before we go on, since we're a nice, cozy, small group, let's just go, well, we don't have to go around the circle, but let's just list some situations that you're either in right now yourself or people that you're living very close to that you believe you could be called into more intentional caregiving with, or situations in your local community. Just quickly, I don't want to take a lot of time on this. Anybody want to?
My friend, his husband died about a year ago.
Uh-huh.
And strangely, I think maybe 3 or 4 months after the death, she did not seem to be particularly affected by it, and she's now feeling more peace.
Yes.
And more anger, especially at him.
Yeah, very typical that one of the women that's going to start in the group that I lead this fall came to me. It's been 2 years this summer. She's, I'm just now ready to start looking at some of the issues. And I think sometimes the whole first year after a death is just sheer coping, and then all these issues start coming up. And that's a real issue in intentional caregiving, because over and over again, this silence which leads to isolation. It's come out here too. People say, no one ever asks me how I am, and I'm not okay. I need to talk about this. So again, the wisdom from this personification, if you know, and it's in your community, the wisdom is to know that, you know, I wonder if they maybe have some things, and I wonder if I could do something, be something to that person. Any other ones you'd like to mention?
I have a friend in England that got divorced after about 20 years, and her husband really never got over the divorce. And he committed suicide early this year. And when I heard about it, I immediately sent her a card. And she says she was, that was The only car she got, because everybody blamed her. They said, well, if you had stayed with him, he wouldn't have committed suicide. Mm-hmm. But she was, I mean, she just couldn't live.
That's a double whammy, divorce and suicide, which are two of the highly stigmatized kind of grief and loss experiences.
And
the people that I'm working with now with the suicide are just, it's only been 4 months, and she was a senior in high school, and the whole community was really riveted by this. And they're starting to experience a lot of that kind of stigmatization when they go anywhere in the community socially. It's like, who are they, the ones that, you know? So it's a double whammy with divorce and suicide. Yeah. And that those kinds of people need a whole bunch of support from us.
So I just, am I doing the right thing?
Absolutely. Absolutely. In fact, one of my sessions next week is going to be intentional caregiving through card ministry. I design my own cards that are up in the bookstore, and that's one of the reasons I like to collect cards. When came out of my own experience that after losing my brother and my father to cancer right in succession in my early 20s, I was just so engulfed with, now who's going to be here for my mother? You know, really, in that incredible gap in silence. So I started sending her a postcard a week with scripture or something upbeat. And since that, I have developed a real ongoing ministry that I've been doing for 20 years of keep sending the cards, because it's like the book I want to write someday. What happens 3 days after they pick up the casseroles? You know, we're all inundated at the time, and everybody sends a card at the time of the death, but it is long-term that people need cards. And that's one of the ways you can do intentional caregiving. You're absolutely right. And if you're the only one that sent a card, then keep being the only one. You know, keep doing that, because it's not just one card. She's going to, and then she'll know that there is one voice out there, at least, that understands me, and that gives a tremendous amount of hope.
Yeah.
Elie Wiesel talks about that. Some of you may read Elie Wiesel, the Jewish writer who survived the Holocaust, and that one of the incredible silence of the church, of people that knew what was going on and didn't say anything, and that only translates into death and isolation. And so one of the things that he did with a whole group of people was to go to Cambodia during the Vietnam War and stand outside of the prison gates of the prisoners of war and holler in there that we know you're here. It's that one voice. And that's what I'm really getting at with intentional caregiving, is maybe you are the only voice that someone else is going to hear. And then that's tremendously hopeful, because you'll think, oh, I guess I'm not crazy. Mm-hmm. And normal grief is not pathological, but people feel crazy in any kind of grief. People, women who lose a husband and they're maybe have lived a wonderful long married life together, and sort of a natural kind of death. Even those situations, people feel crazy, not to mention suicide. Anything else you'd like to mention about specific situations?
Well, I don't know how common my experience is. For those who weren't here yesterday, my husband was killed by a drunk driver in October, so I'm going into the, well, coming upon my first year. Having people come up and ask me how I'm doing is awful.
Yes.
Because I have to try to put words to confusion, and then they'll say, and then how are the children doing? Well, it depends on the day, and it depends upon the child, and it depends upon the moment. And so much more helpful is when someone says, you've been on my mind and I've really been thinking about you, so that I'm not forced to have to try to put language to what I'm experiencing.
Oh, yeah. Thank you for sharing that. That's a really important point in intentional caregiving, that it's not invasive, that we do not put people on the spot. But that's what I mean about, I don't know, maybe correct me, maybe you don't like this either, but I always say coffee hour at church, using that as a metaphor for however you're meeting people socially. People know your situation. It seems to me a much more helpful thing would be to just look at you and say, I'm thinking about you, give you a little touch in some way that doesn't feel invasive. And that's, again, why cards are, I think, are so helpful, because then you know that that's a person that really cares. If they care enough to keep sending you cards, you know, hey, this person is really interested in me. And one of the ways I think we can give intentional care to other people is in a card to say, just wondering how you are, would like to take you out for coffee, or come over to my house, or whatever, get together sometime if you feel like it, or when you feel like it. If you do, let me know. Because another reality of people in grief, especially in your situation, I think it's a very traumatizing grief, is that you don't have any energy to reach out. A lot of people don't have energy in grief. So that we have to be intentional caregivers, because very few people have the energy in the throes of grief to call up even their best friend and say, could we get together today? I really need you. Does that?
Well, and the other part that's really hard is I've had people reach out to me where there hasn't been enough of a relationship there for me to want to share my innermost being with them. Mm-hmm. The people who I'm counting on now had earned the right to be there in that very really vulnerable moment.
Yes, yes.
And I have had people who have heard about my situation and thought it sounded like something that they related to and wanted to call up and connect, and I just am not willing
to. It's a trust issue, and it depends on the nature of the relationship and your own vulnerability, because it's a very vulnerable time. One of the things about intentional caregiving that I also believe in, however, is, you know, one thing that tends to happen a lot, I hear this a lot, maybe this hasn't happened to you, but sometimes the people that we rely on from our old relationships aren't there for us. That happens a lot. And you have looked to them and you expected them to come around and they didn't, and maybe that hasn't happened to you, but it happens to a lot of people. So there's that tension. And then there's also the gift of people that I think are angels, that are sent to you, that if they keep, like, say, let's use the image or metaphor of sending cards, or in whatever way they initiate to you, eventually you begin to see that this is a new gift for me that's come. Mm-hmm. I didn't know this person before, but they're an angel. I really believe that, and I've experienced that, and I do a lot of that kind of work myself now. One story I will use to illustrate that is that maybe some of you know of former ALC congregations, President Kent Knudsen, who was dying of this rare oriental disease, Jakob Creutzfeldt's disease. Well, he was dying at North Memorial Hospital in Minneapolis at the same time my father was dying of cancer, and I would drive by North Memorial Hospital every day on my way to work in Robbinsdale, and I would think, I wonder who's there for Norman Knudsen, his wife, because they're very famous. He's the president of the church. The whole church was praying for his healing. And I thought, you know, I wonder if because they're famous and everybody knows them, maybe she isn't as surrounded as people think. So I started sending her cards. I had never met her. I never even heard Kent Knudsen speak. I just didn't know who he was before he became the president. So what I'm talking about is initiating caregiving in a new situation, too. As it turned out, Norma Knudsen was at that time on the Board of Regents at Augsburg College, as was my husband's uncle. And she said to him at a meeting, is this your wife that's sending me these lovely cards? I keep getting these cards and I don't know this person. And he said, no, it's my nephew's wife. And so he said to me, why don't you take her out for lunch? And I said, are you kidding me? I was sort of intimidated. I didn't know them. And I didn't know them, and I was intimidated by their fame. Well, I did. I wrote this letter and I said, I'd like to take you out for lunch. If you'd like to go, call me. I mean, I didn't even have guts to call her. So she did. She called me and she said, I would love to meet you and let's do this. So we set it up. And the very night we had set to go out to eat, my father died. And I was called home and it was impending any minute because he died of cancer. Well, as it turned out in our conversation, when we finally did get together down the road, I was right. She was very isolated. She had, of course, a few family friends, you know, and relatives. But by and large, you know, the whole church was praying, and yet there were very few people that were embodied that came along to say, I'll be with you. There were the obvious people, and Julie and I have talked about the story because she knows some of her relatives, and there, you know, it wasn't to say that she didn't have any support at all. Do you hear what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
But what I'm saying is that our friendship grew out of initiation to someone in a situation, and I think that's how the Spirit of God works in these kinds of ministries, to lay on your heart people that you maybe don't know. And so one of the things I say in intentional caregiving is to read the newspaper in your community. I could give many, many stories about this kind of initiating to people that you don't know. But if this is your thing, and this is I told on the first day, my calling, I think my bliss in life that comes out of my own pain, is that I know how much I needed it, and I know how few people ever came around for my mom in terms of the long-term healing. So I believe very much in that kind of intentional thinking into something and being creative with what you can do. And I'm going to do a session next week on real practical things are, that are involved in this area. Any other thing anybody would like to mention?
A shock and a grief in our family is that one of my sisters was one of the teachers at Stockton Elementary School where the Asian children were shot and killed last February. In fact, she carried one of the little girls dying on the playground into the classroom. And I think that was a national tragedy and shock. And I'm thinking also that it probably reawakened some unresolved grief in my sister and husband because they lost their 4-year-old 13 years ago. And I don't suppose you ever really get over the loss of a child either. And I'm thinking now that I made a lot of phone calls because we live in Minnesota and live in California in, right away, but then you know, I kind of got caught up in my other things
too. Right.
And,
yeah.
This is helping me again on the fact that that isn't over.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, nothing's ever over in terms of life process and grief, I mean, and life and death issues, they're not over with. We just reprocess them, and as one of my Catholic sister spiritual directors has helped me realize, you just go into deeper levels of healing. And I think you're raising a very good point that things that happen, events that happen around us can trigger our own unresolved grief, i.e. you're losing your own child. And the groups that I lead, several people have come in at different stages of their grief. And I'm thinking of one woman who was on the video 2 days ago who had a divorce 10 years ago, and right after that her father died. Stuffed all of it, as did their whole family system, for 10 years. And she was standing at a party this last Christmas, and one of my bosses put his arm around her and said, "How are you?" And she just burst into tears. And it's like, where is this well coming from? And then she had a friend, her neighbor was in one of the groups that I lead, and she knew that little voices, the spirit, whatever, were telling her that, hey, maybe you should take a look at this now, 10 years later. So I firmly believe, too, in that process, that sometimes we aren't able, for whatever reason, at the time of the trauma in our life, but it's a process. And so she's taken a look at these issues in the group that have been 10 years old, and her whole family is now in therapy, and amazing healings are coming out of that process. Anything else at this point?
My story, I guess, is always going to be the counter of what you're saying. But I feel the need that I need to make my needs known.
Yes.
I can't expect people out there to guess where I'm
right.
at. And like when I was coming upon my first Christmas, I put a call into some friends out in California and said, "I can't be alone for Christmas." And she said, "Don't say another word. It's done." And the situation was arranged for children, and I had to come out and stay, not with a family, which would have been very difficult, but in a hotel space so that we could interact with some friends and family. But they wouldn't have ever thought that that was my need.
Exactly. Is that what you mean by being counter to what I'm saying?
Yeah. I'm saying, instead of trying to guess the person in greetings needs, we also need to tell people,
exactly,
I'm here, but you need to tell you,
exactly,
what you're needing.
Right. Exactly. And I don't mean to not be saying that, but I think that's another counterpoint to this conversation, and it could be another whole session in of itself, that you are very resourceful, and you know you're not. One of the images I gave a couple sessions ago was of this unnamed woman in the Bible who had been hemorrhaging for 12 years. But she was resourceful enough to know she needed healing, and she decided that if she saw this Jesus, she could go touch the hem of his garment, and she knew she would be healed if she could get there, and she was, because of the depth of her faith, and she touched the hem, and Jesus' power has gone out of me. But you are resourceful in this freshness of your grief. A lot of people aren't. And so it's both and, it's not either or at all. The other image there is the woman at the well who we talked about in that session, who was so cast off and so beaten down by so much alienation and grief in her community for the rejection of 5 husbands and whatever all happened there. And she's sitting at, this is sort of what I would imagine it would look like, and she's sitting there and she needs to be encountered, and she was, by this Christ. So we're in all of that. We're every place and in and out and never only at one place with it. Sometimes in grief we need to be encountered because we're so beaten down we don't even know what our need is. And when we are encountered by the Christ, i.e. by another friend, intentional caregiving, we have so much energy, or at least we start getting energy, that we can go on. And in her case, she went out and told all the villagers, come and see this man who knows everything about me and receives me still. So sometimes we're the outcast woman that's beaten down. Sometimes we're the Christ who can, you know. And sometimes we're the unnamed woman, I believe, who knows that we need help, but no one else is going to know unless we tell them. So I think that's speaking to what you're saying.
Yeah, and just another slant to that was when I was here, I got an emergency phone call that I needed to call home. And I have a 19 and 17-year-old son staying with a friend, and my 19-year-old son at the time I came out to Holden had decided he was going to go to college, and then he decided he wasn't going to go to college. And the last I heard is he wasn't going, and he was going to live at home, and he was going to work. And all of a sudden he got all of his orientation papers and had second thoughts, and I'm out here, and he wants to fly from Minneapolis to Nashville. Well, my immediate reaction was guilt that I wasn't where I needed to be. But I found out he borrowed the money from a friend of mine who put it on her credit card, and he found another friend of my husband's in Nashville to pick him up, and it almost, my first reaction was, oh my gosh, we've intruded on these people's lives. And then I thought, no, I've got to step back and let other people be there for him. And he pulled this thing off, and he should be in class Monday morning. And it all happened outside of my ability to take care of all the family's things. Mm-hmm. And so I guess what I'm learning is to let other people step in and to give myself this time to mm-hmm. be away and not feel mm-hmm. like I'm shirking my duties. Mm-hmm.
Thank you for sharing that. Anything else at this point? Okay. What I want to go on now to do is just make a few comments. See, what time is this session over? In 15 minutes? Quarter to? Yeah. Okay, I have a video section I'd like to show, but just before we do that, I want to go on to talk about why I think we need to address this issue in the, we'll speak of the church, community, in friendships, family, wherever you are. I would just like to read off very, very quickly the needs of the people, in addition to what you just said about the people that are in my groups at the present time, and talk about the ongoing needs that are present in grief situations. And I'm doing a lot of videos of now that I have, many more than I can even have time to show out here, of reflections of people that have been in the group now for a year, and their increased awareness of other people's situations as a result of being in the group. Because what happens to us is whatever our particular grief situation is, we get so engulfed in that that we aren't even aware of all the other kinds of grief around us, which is one of the joys, actually, of being in a group to process grief. As you start being in community and realizing, one of my images for that is that it's like a fraction. Pain is the lowest denominator, and the top of the fraction is your particular situation. And that's one of the gifts of a group. I have a couple whose daughter committed suicide in March. She was 18. And one of their issues that's just surfacing, not to mention many, many others, is the father's drinking that was happening before but now is really getting exacerbated, and some marriage issues. I have a woman whose husband was killed by a drunk driver 6 years ago and left her with three preschoolers. She's now remarried. She's going to be on the video. But the ongoing issues of her daughter, they're all girls, of her daughters, having one of them didn't even know what a father was because she was an infant when this happened. The ongoing parenting issues, and that's a real issue that we are not dealing with enough in the church at all, is single parenting, or like we talked about yesterday, blended family situations. And there's a tremendous amount of ongoing grief that has to be processed somewhere with children. Two women that I dealt with have both had little babies that were born perfectly healthy, it seemed to be, and they died, both of them, 2 days after birth. And women who lose infants or women who have miscarriages have not been given enough permission to grieve, because the euphemisms are, oh, well, you know, it was just a little baby, and I'm sure you can have another one. Or with miscarriages, it's real hidden, and it's like, oh, well, it wasn't a baby yet, and I'm sure it wasn't meant to be born, I'm sure you could get pregnant again. And women need permission and to tell those kinds of stories in a grief group. a woman whose zany college brother laid down on the tracks just to goof off. They didn't think there was any drinking involved, and they fell asleep, and a train came by and killed him. And what the death of that young man did is just jar the family system, which is what one of the things that happens in a death, I believe. I see it over and over again, is that, you know, one of the images is that life is going along pretty well as we thought it should be, but when we lose someone very close on this circle, wherever the relationship to us, it jars loose the family system. That happens over and over again. This woman I mentioned whose little children drowned is suicidal, highly suicidal. And one of the issues I've come in touch with is, I am not a therapist, I am not a psychiatrist, I don't work out of the clinical medical model at all. I'm working in this kind of situation out of an educational model. Spirituality is what I would say. And interestingly enough, this woman has dealt with a psychiatrist who is one of these very distant, hardly doesn't even know her name when she calls in for an appointment, quickly hears her situation, says, well, you got to be admitted, you got to go in the hospital, you know, you're probably crazy, because she feels suicidal. Well, a lot of people feel suicidal, and like they take their life and for varying kinds of grief. Interestingly enough, I also referred her to a therapist, and that relationship didn't work out for who knows what reason. She comes to this group, and I, as much as you can ever document or prove anything with human beings, what I've seen that's amazing is an amazing amount of light starting to sparkle in her eyes, and some healing is happening because she's loved by five other women that sit in this group with her every week and hear her story. And I believe that there is an amazing amount of healing and power and love through Christ, through Christian community. Now, at some point, she may need to be hospitalized, she may need clinical help, she may need drugs, I don't know, you know. But I'm a firm believer in holistic treatment for whatever we feel we're not well about. And Christian community being a tremendous power in that respect. Another woman whose brilliant son at MIT committed suicide. Just highly gifted in math and a leader in the community, and a tremendous amount of mystery around his death far, far away out on the East Coast. And this is a very devout, intensely introspective woman who's very intelligent and searches and is in tremendous pain still. It's been 18 months after, and so she's been in the group processing. Part of it being the unknowns. Another woman whose 25-year-old daughter was killed in a dune buggy accident in Australia with her boyfriend. They were driving on the beach in this mysterious accident. They just sort of flipped over, and he was fine, and she was killed instantly. And that's shaken up all kinds of her midlife issues, and it's the baby of the family, and tremendous amount of depression. This woman stays in bed most of the day because she just can't cope. Another woman whose dad committed suicide when he couldn't cope with his wife's cancer. They're probably like in their early 60s. His wife had cancer and he couldn't handle it, so he committed suicide. Well, Anne is left with a father who committed suicide that she's very angry about, because now she, and then her mother is very, very ill, and so that all those relationships are in a tremendous amount of turmoil. Another woman in our community whose father died of cancer 2 years ago, she's been in my group and is needing to talk about her family system, which doesn't talk about anything. They grew up in a very happy family where everything's gone fine and very successful, etc. When her father died at age 57, this was her first introduction to grief through loss and death. Her mother is journaling profusely and gives me all her journaling, but her mother and the mother and daughter can't talk about the father's death. The mother's going to be in my group this fall. The daughter was in the group this spring, and one of their issues is, how can we talk about this as a family? They don't talk. They only talk about happy things. Happy talk. That's another ongoing issue. I'm citing all these examples because this is not unusual. This is typical of any congregation, any community that we all live in. Another woman who just came to me, was just referred to her, whose daughter had just gotten married, 10 months ago, they had got pregnant right away, and they had this, she got with this little baby. She became very ill into the pregnancy from a strange muscle disease and died. So they took the baby 7 weeks before the due date. The mother died, and the baby's living and is fine, hasn't had a lot of setbacks because of the early birth. And so this mother is left with no daughter, but a grandchild who she can't even look at because it's so painful. And, okay. Another young woman whose husband dropped dead of a stroke doing his yard work at age 39 and left her with three small children, and her ongoing grief issues of being parenting, single parenting. Another woman, and this is a hopeful note maybe to integrate into the next thing, is that her dad died when she was five, and her mother absolutely wouldn't even tell her how he died. We didn't talk about it, we just went on, and then she quickly remarried and said to this woman, who is now like 40-something, "Now this is your new dad, and you're going to love him." Well, she hated him, of course, because of all the denial, and you just don't do that. And so she said, "I could have been spared 40 years of pain, or 30, whatever it's been, if we could have just talked about it. Why did my dad die? How did he die? Wait to get married, and then let me have this be my stepfather. It's not my father." All those kinds of issues. And these are not uncommon. These are life stories that people have that we're bumping around with. So normal grief is not pathological, but it has to be dealt with. Another thing I'm concerned about is the church, in most cases, does not, now you disagree with me if you don't see it this way, does not have it on the educational agenda, i.e., we don't easily talk about it in our Bible studies, in our Sunday school classes. I've mentioned a lot of these resources. I've got a lot more too, but for children's books, for getting it on the agenda, in publications, in the library, whatever. How do you get it on the agenda? That's an open-ended question. We get stuck or caught between our good intentions and actually following through, and the result is isolation and silence. And I think the fact that we are all, I think most of us here anyway, are confessing Christians, or what I understand the Christian faith to be, is it's incarnational. God is with us in Christ, i.e. we are little Christ, we are Christ to others. And the black women writers, as I mentioned the other day, have taught me a lot about how that Christ is embodied, in body, mind, and spirit, which means if Christ is embodied in us, it ought to come out through our bodies. Our voice, saying something to someone, our physical presence with another person, in our mind, in the terms of how we can creatively and give care intentionally or be there. One of my friends has a flower budget. She brings flowers at unexpected times to people that she knows are hurting. And who doesn't just love to have someone knock at the door and hand you a bouquet of daisies or whatever? Doesn't have to cost a lot of money, but very creative, intentional caregiving. And Christ is also embodied in our spirits through praying for people and really caring about them through prayer. That card that says there are times when the only thing we can give one another is prayer. And I remember the times in my life when, as I mentioned before in other sessions, when one of my good high school friends had been killed in Vietnam, and this is the time when my father and then my brother died of cancer, and I was just always in a cancer hospital, or I was in a nursing home. I was just enmeshed in death, as Vietnam era was anyway. And I was just groping and reading anything I could get my hands on to try to figure out some kind of healing out of all this. And one of the dominant themes I found in some of the spirituality literature is that the most powerful gift you can give anyone is to pray. Now, that's not that you just sit and pray and don't come around, because they don't know that you're there for them either. But that's a tremendously powerful releasing tool we have. That also, that the mystery of the cross, as I've mentioned before, is this transformation process, that our grief and sorrow and pain is transformed into the love and the light that we give to other people. That if we're walking in this journey of the cross and we're asking questions that we've never asked before, that our life experiences confront us with, we have these wounds and these scars, whatever our life experience has been. And those wounds and scars are the very root of our love and light. Okay, do you want to see the video, or do you want to do some more talking about discussing? I see you've got about 15 minutes left. I'll let the group decide at this point what you'd rather do. Anybody have any opinions about that?
I do not.
Okay, I'll quickly tell you about the video. Again, one of my passions in terms of being very much enmeshed in the church and trying to live this out in my own faith is that we need to get it on the educational agenda. And so one of the things I did this past year is give an adult forum series called Living with Loss. And those of you that saw the video yesterday saw one version of that. Two people in our church, they're not even from our church, but here's another image. I believe very much in what I call the healing power of gentle initiation. And I could unpack that in a whole hour's presentation, but what I basically mean by that is that if you gently initiate in all the different ways we've talked about to someone to let them know you care, there's a tremendous amount of healing power in that. And what I did in the thing I talked about yesterday is this project of talking with people, initiating relationships with people that are in blended families that have come together from two different marriages and they're putting kids together. So the thing you're going to see today is four adults, none of who go to our church, which was kind of nice too. And Duluth, Minnesota is what I call a big small town, so that it's not a huge city where everybody feels anonymous. But all four people at this forum, I think most people in our church knew at least one of them from the community. So I asked them if they would be willing to come to tell their story about their struggle of putting their story of putting their marriage together and blending these families. And as we talked yesterday, the one yesterday was a very kind of heavy story, in that Jerry and Nancy had both lost their spouses to cancer and blended six teenagers, which is many issues in itself, but they had leftover cancer pain that takes a long time to process out. And 6 teenagers is probably the biggest order I could think of from two different family systems, and you're trying to be a family. Patty and Tom, we're going to see in a minute, had a very different situation. Patty's husband was killed by a drunk driver, as I mentioned before, and left her with 3 preschoolers. She's from Duluth. She had lived on the East Coast where the accident happened, and she was lucky to come back to Duluth where she had her parents, who are very, very supportive. But she's mentioned many, many times, and this is by way of introducing the video, that she really didn't know anybody else in the community anymore, you know, when you come back to where you used to live and all the relationships are different. So she felt very isolated, and she would have given anything to have this group at that time. But she came into the group last fall with 6 years ago her husband died. She's remarried. On the surface, it looks like, oh, isn't that wonderful? Patty's remarried, and it is wonderful. And she's got a new family, but those issues are not gone, as we said, from 6 years ago. So that's who Patty is. Tom, when we interviewed for my husband interviewed for his job in Duluth, the headline of the paper was that Mrs. Wheeler had been killed as she was biking up the North Shore in Minnesota. She was riding her bike and she was mysteriously killed. And everybody knew them in the town, and that was, you know, I thought, oh my gosh, you know, I would love to bike up the North Shore. Does this mean, you know, a woman isn't safe to bike anymore? So he was left with 3 small children. So this is another story of initiation too, because Patty is very active in MAD, you know, Women Against Drunk Drivers, Mothers Against Drunk Drivers. And I had heard her speak at our church, and I was aware of her story in the community, although she didn't know me. And I was also aware of Tom. So our children went to the same elementary school as all their children. And this just happened a year ago, March, May, whenever it was, May, I think. And I walked up to her and I said, I know you're Patty Wheeler, but you don't know me. And she said, no, I guess I don't. And I told her who I was and that I was working at Bell Brothers Funeral Home, and I was putting together a research project on people in blended families. And I said, no, I realize this is a disclaimer. This is one way I have had success anyway in approaching people. I said, I realize that this could be a very invasive thing to ask you, so please feel free to just say no. But I'm wondering if I could come over and talk with you about your story. She said, yeah, that'd be great. And I could tell you many, many other stories of similar kinds of initiations. The point being that I really believe most people will respond to that kind of an invitation if they can sense that you really care about them and you're not just out for some information, okay? So I went over and had this interview with her, which went into the project, and told her about the group that I was going to start and would she ever be interested in being in it. She said, I'll think about that. Well, last summer I called her again and yeah, she wanted to be in it. So that's how she's one of my best friends in Duluth now, in addition to being in the group, which has come out of the group process. So then she and Tom, I said, would Tom be willing to do this? So she asked Tom. And so what they did, the video we're going to see is their version of their issues.
Their ages were 6 weeks old, four, just turning four, and just turning six. And I really wasn't sure what I would do at that point. My parents live here in Duluth, so I came back with them after the funeral. I'd also like to say that was the first, other than my grandfather's, that had died. When I was in grade school, that was really the first funeral I'd ever attended. I'd never had any friends who'd lost anyone, and so it was all new to me, and no anyone else had ever lost anyone. I came back here and stayed with my parents for a while, trying to figure out what I would do, because I really had no idea what I should do. And since my children were so young, and my parents were very supportive, I did move back here. I got my own house, and I've never regretted that move. I think it might have made it harder for the kids, but then they also had that extra support from my parents, which they wouldn't have had out there. People were really wonderful about it. Out in Jersey, we had just lived there for a year, and the community was very supportive. People brought in things, food, and I never knew all those people. And that does help. Coming back here, in some ways, maybe I sort of set myself up for a hard situation because I didn't know, other than my parents and some of their friends, I didn't really know anybody. And meeting new people, I didn't want their first impression to be crying on my shoulder. So I didn't share a lot of what I'd gone through with anybody when I first moved back. And part of it, too, is because I didn't know anybody else that had lost it. So I didn't feel real comfortable talking about it with people. The things that helped me the most were people, parents of my friends that I'd known growing up, stopping by, bringing things by. I had one of my parents' friends, she just seemed to be able to pick the right times. It'd be a time when I was sort of alone, and she'd show up at the front door. And I would have never have called these people up. So I think it's real important that you just stop by, write someone a note, because to let them know that you're thinking of them. As far as what to say or do for someone, there is nothing you can say. There are no right words or there are no wrong words. It's basically if you let someone know that you care and you're thinking about them, don't expect the people to call you when they're down, because most people will not do that. I'm speaking for myself, I would never have called someone who says, I'm really down today, please come over and talk to me. I also had a new friend, and one of the things that she did for me that meant a lot to me, she called me up one morning and said, I'm going to stop by and get some donuts when I come over and have breakfast with you. And there again, it was a day when things just sort of weren't going right, and it really made me feel better. As far as grieving, I think that as a single parent with young kids, it's real hard to take the time to grieve. I would find that in the morning when it would really sort of hit me that, well, we're doing it, you're doing this all by yourself now, how are you going to handle this? My next thought was, I've got to get the kids ready for school and get them ready, and so I, went on. And in the evening, by the time I had them in bed, and I could have maybe taken the time to think about things, I was just too tired, and it felt so good to have them in bed. And there were so many days, especially around dinner time, trying to get the kids fed and having an infant, trying to get her through the supper hour. There were a lot of times I remember thinking, I don't think I can do this. I mean, I just felt so overwhelmed with all of it. And there again, being new to the community, I know there would have been people that would have reached out, but I didn't feel comfortable asking for that help, which is where my parents helped me tremendously. They would come in and help take care of the kids, give me time just to go to the grocery store, whatever. For me, the thing that helped me the most was probably as a result of my husband's death being caused by a drunk driver. I got very involved with Mothers Against Drunk Driving. And that, I think the first time I could really open up and just kind of let everything come out and start to heal was that that Christmas of that the year it was killed, I went down to Minneapolis, St. Paul. They had a candlelight vigil, which Mary puts on yearly. And I mean, you had to get up, and you didn't have to. If you chose to, you could get up in front of them and tell them who you lost. And I did that, and I was a basket case there. But so were a lot of the other people, and I realized I think the reason I could do that was because I knew that everybody there understood. And finally, that Christmas was a little bit easier, I think, because I had been able to share that with other people and who also cared and understood. And it was sort of a relief to see that the kids still got excited over Christmas, and I kind of realized my first glimpse that life still can go on and you can still be happy. I'd say it took me a good 2 years to be comfortable being single. During that time, I wanted to be there, I wanted to be comfortable with it, but reality was that I wasn't. I don't know how you get to that point. It just, it's different for everybody. I had done some dating, and I enjoyed that, but it was, some of the dates were more because it was either going out on a date or sitting home by myself. And I finally got to the point where I thought, I don't care if I sit home by myself. It's, you know, this is, it's okay. This is not my choice to be single, but the four of us can be very happy. For the kids, I think I really pulled the rug out from them by coming back here, knowing that it was so fun, that it was in the school and the neighborhood with friends. That was real hard on me. But they did seem to adjust pretty well. My oldest, I'd say a year after her father's death, I did take her in to counseling because she seemed real angry about things. And I guess in my own mind, it wasn't really a conscious decision, but I think that I thought, if I just keep things going here, the kids don't have to feel what I feel, and we'll be real happy. And reality is that they have to feel it too. They have to go through that. And I just had fun with all that. And they did go through the group support group at St. Mary's, which I think was good for them, but they weren't even old enough, and that wasn't available until 2 years after his death. I would have liked to have had them go through it right away, but it wasn't available. Unfortunately, not those things are. It was real hard to watch the kids. I think harder, it was much harder for me to watch them than for myself, because I had grown up with a mother and father who was very close to my father. Had been a big part of my life, just always there. And I just couldn't imagine what that would be like for my children not to have that. And my oldest, there were times when I'd watch her, the neighborhood that we moved into, we were the only single parent family there. And the family next door had three daughters, and the father used to play with the kids a lot.